matters by either party?
Not from the appellant, Your Honor.
Nothing from the state, Your Honor.
We're on record in Hairston versus the state of Idaho, matters before the court for oral argument. Attorney for the appellant is Jonah Horwitz, and on behalf of the respondent, Lamont Anderson. You may proceed, Mr. Horwitz.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Nearly 25 years have passed since James Hairston was sentenced to death. And in that time, not a single other defendant in Idaho who was under the age of 21 at the time of his offense has received a death sentence. And in the same period of time, death sentences for under 21 defendants have dropped dramatically nationwide, going from 47 in 1994 to 9 in 2017, which is a decline of more than 80%. So those are just two of the most compelling statistics that show that society no longer views late adolescents as among the worst of the worst for whom the death penalty is reserved. There are two claims before the court. There's a categorical claim that no defendant under the age of 21 can be sentenced to death. And there's a process-based claim alleging that Mr. Hairston in particular did not receive the amount of consideration of his youth as mitigating at his sentencing. Today, I'll focus primarily on the merits of the first claim. I'll speak briefly about the second claim, and I'm of course happy to answer any questions the court may have about anything in the briefs. Turning to the first claim, the categorical claim, it has two parts. It has a national component and it has a statewide component. And I'll address the national component. There are three factors.
Mr. Horwitz, I'm sorry to interrupt you right as you begin, but I really would like to pin down the standard review for this case. It seems to me that you argue at times in your brief that we should remand for evidentiary hearing or other further circumstances in the trial court, but isn't this a de novo review where we're looking at the constitutionality of Idaho's death penalty scheme? And in fact, as the Supreme Court says, we have to exercise our own independent judgment. Irrespective of what the trial courts or trial court in this case may have held. So aren't we looking at this from a de novo perspective so that there really is no place for any evidentiary or remand because it's up to us to make those independent objective determinations?
Your Honor, I believe the standard of review with respect to the ultimate constitutional question of whether Mr. Hairston's Eighth Amendment claim is meritorious would be de novo. I think that is a question of law, essentially. Our position is that the court can grant relief on the papers without an evidentiary hearing. I think the record is very clear. It's uncontroverted. The data and the scientific evidence is very strong. And all of that would support a determination that the evolving standards have changed and the line should be moved to 21. That said, I don't think it would be appropriate for the court to deny the claim without an evidentiary hearing, because I think at a bare minimum, we've made a prima facie case. We've alleged a constitutional violation. We've presented data to support it. If there's any question about whether that evidence is sufficient, then I think the proper result would be to have an evidentiary hearing in the district court. One benefit of that would be to hear from Dr. Steinberg, who's the expert, whose report we attached to our petition. He's a preeminent authority in this field, and he indicated in his report that basically the science no longer supports the cutoff at age 18. So he could take the stand at an evidentiary hearing, the state could cross-examine him, the district judge could hear from him in person. Dr. Steinberg has testified at similar hearings in other cases, including in the Cruz case out of the District of Connecticut that's discussed in the briefs, as well as the Kentucky state case where a similar claim was actually, relief was granted on a similar claim.
So if we send this back for an evidentiary hearing on whether the line should be 21, I mean, what's the question presented to the trial court? Who's going to determine it? A jury, the trial court in the first instance? And what's the standard that they're supposed to apply for whether this line has changed. More probably than not, clear and convincing evidence. I mean, it seems to me that this is purely as presented. It's a policy matter.
Well, a couple of responses, Your Honor. First of all, I would respectfully disagree with the characterization of it as a policy matter to the extent that that suggests that it's not a judicial matter, because certainly the courts address and resolve claims of this type as they have to under the U.S. Supreme Court's precedent. And the U.S. Supreme Court obviously assesses the evolving standards of decency regularly. So I think it's incumbent on every court to engage in that same type of analysis. As to the question of the standard of review below, it would be a bench trial, if you want to call it that, or really just an evidentiary hearing. I think the standard that the district judge would apply would be the preponderance of the evidence standard that applies in any post-conviction proceeding. And I think the question the district judge would ask would be, has Mr. Hairston demonstrated by a preponderance of the evidence that the evolving standards of decency have shifted and that the line should be changed to 21. And I would add, in the supplemental briefing that's taken place most recently in this appeal, the state has questioned the validity of some of the data that Mr. Hairston has presented, I think by criticizing Professor Bloom in its supplemental brief. And to the extent there's any question about that data or any evidence really in this case, I think the benefit of an evidentiary hearing would be that the district judge could consider that data. He could take whatever testimony he thought necessary to evaluate that data, and he could render a decision about what it signified. Just to briefly review the factors that inform this court's determination of the national claim, there's science, there is the criminal justice system, and finally, there's the more general cultural landscape. In terms of the science, I referred to Dr. Steinberg, and he's really the one who I think elaborates on our argument as to the scientific factors, and I would refer the court to his report. It's in the record at page 293. He's someone who's been cited repeatedly by the Supreme Court in this area of law.
Before we get further into the scientific standards, I guess I find it helpful sometimes to know where we're going by understanding how we got to where we are. Is the 18-year-old standard that was set by the Supreme Court, did they get there because of science, or did they get there just by recognizing that the 18 is the age of majority, and that seemed like the most logical place to put things? I mean, I understand the role that science has played in some of these past decisions, but is that really how we ended up with the 18-year-old limit that we have now?
Your Honor, I think it's a combination of all of those things. The Roper Court certainly referred to the scientific evidence about juveniles. I think other Eighth Amendment cases have delved into the science more extensively than the Roper Court. I think all of those decisions, they evaluate data in different areas. So they look at the science, they also look at where society is drawing lines to divide adults from younger individuals. They look at sentencing outcomes. I think that's a very important factor in this area of law. What are young defendants actually being sentenced to for first degree murder? And that may be the most significant factor of all, because that really, that most directly reflects where the public at large is on the question of how culpable young defendants are and whether they are deserving of the harshest penalties. So I would say it's a combination of all of those factors. I don't think the court, I think the evolving standards of decency is by definition a flexible, not rigid test. And as the court has said a number of times, it's ultimately, or at least the final question the court asks is whether in its own judgment, it's appropriate to exempt the class at issue from the death penalty or from life without the possibility of parole, whatever the sentence at issue might be. So I would say it's a flexible balancing test that takes into consideration all of those factors. And I think it's interesting, you bring up some of the lines that were drawn at 18, which is also an emphasis that the state places in this case. But I think the more telling question to ask is, to the extent there's change, what direction is that change going? And the way the Supreme Court has described it in Atkins v. Virginia is, what's the consistency of the direction of change? And if you take into account some of those lines that were drawn at 18, they have actually been changed to 21. So that's true of tobacco. That's true of juvenile court jurisdiction, which the Supreme Court in Thompson v. Oklahoma described as the, quote, most important of the societal factors that it was considering. So I think those changes are quite significant. And I think when you're considering that part of the test, those general societal rules, I think the movement is the most significant thing to consider.
So Mr. Horwitz, the question I have is, through what lens do we view this societal change? I mean, Mr. Harrison was sentenced 25 years ago, as you said. Do we look at the sentencing 25 years ago, or do we look at it through the current societal view? And how do we determine which lens to look at it?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I think there are different ways to look at it. I think one way to look at it, and I would say our approach is to look at the change over time from Mr. Hairston's sentencing to the present, which I think is a logical method, because the question really is, how have standards changed over time? And particularly when you talk about our state-centric claim, I think it's most sensible to look at what has happened in Idaho since Mr. Hairston was sentenced to death. And as we explain in the briefs, not a single other defendant in that age group has been sentenced to death. I think another way to look at it would be to ask what's happened since Roper was decided. That's the approach that Professor Bloom takes in the Law Review article that we've presented to the court. And I think that has its merits as well, because Roper obviously is the decision that set the line at 18. And the question now is whether that line ought to be moved. So it sort of stands to reason that the historical timeline would take into account, would be focused on that period of time.
So does that approach effectively open up every criminal sentence for review and attack based on the passage of time?
Your Honor, I think it would be fairly easy for the courts to screen out frivolous evolving standards claims if parties didn't have a clear basis to say that the evolving standards have changed. Then I think a court could summarily deny that type of claim.
Other than death penalty cases, has the evolving standards test been applied in other types of crimes?
The evolving standards test has been applied to life without parole sentences in the juvenile context, in the Miller v. Alabama line, which includes Graham v. Florida, Montgomery.
So let me rephrase my question. Other than cases in which there's a possible sentence of life or death, has such an evolving standards test been applied to other sentences?
Your Honor, I can't think off the top of my head of actually there is what some I think would consider the original evolving standards case, which is Trope v. Dulles. That was a sentence, I think, for the sentence in that case was to strip someone of his citizenship, and that was deemed cruel and unusual. And even earlier than that, the Weems case is the case that first uses language kind of suggestive of the evolving standards test. And in that case, the punishment was, I think, 12 years of hard labor. So I think originally, I suppose, these cases did involve non-murder, non-death or life sentences. I think since those earlier cases, the Supreme Court has focused more on death sentences and life without parole sentences.
Well, let me be clear what's on my mind. I mean, there are national discussions going on in our country about sentencings involving drug crimes and about what the role of our penal system is in dealing with addiction and things like that. And so, I mean, I guess my question becomes, you know, depending upon the sentence of a person involving a drug crime, does the Eighth Amendment and this evolving standard notion, does it become a touchstone for defendants to reopen and relitigate their sentences, lengthy ones?
Your Honor, I think it would be very difficult for the defendant in a drug case to invoke the evolving standard successfully. That's partly because, as I said, in response to Justice Mueller's question, the precedent in this area really is focused on the harshest sentences. And even beyond the harshest sentences, you know, there are defendants who have tried to make proportionality type challenges to things like drug sentences. So you see that in Harmelin, for example, and those have failed. Those are exceedingly difficult claims to prevail on. I think the context of the death penalty is unique in its severity, which the Supreme Court has emphasized a number of times in different cases. I would say there's no danger of opening the floodgates because it's already established that the evolving standards create a line in terms of age and the death penalty. And the question is just where should that line rest? The precedent does not establish any sort of rule for drug cases or anything of that nature, aside from the juvenile life without precedent. So I think it would be easy for courts to say there's no law for us to apply here to the question of a drug defendant, for example, and whether his sentence has become cruel and unusual under the evolving standards, and so I'll reject this argument. But when it comes to the death penalty and when it comes to young defendants, I think courts have to apply the evolving standards under Roper and consider whether they've changed or not. I think I will turn to a couple of the state's counterarguments on the national front, just to address them quickly. The state, and I think this is relevant to some of the questions that have been posed so far, the state characterizes our argument as requesting that this court overrule the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's not our request. Roper did not etch the 18-year cutoff in stone forever. I was addressing a 17-year-old defendant, so that's the reason the line was drawn at 18 at that point in time. And evolving standards obviously are by definition evolving. They can change. The Supreme Court and Roper didn't foreclose the possibility of evolution in this area. And there are lower courts who are reassessing the 18-year cutoff under the Eighth Amendment, including the Cruz case that I mentioned and the House opinion from the Illinois Court of Appeals. So I think it makes sense, and I think it's required to ask whether that line should stay there. The state also stresses the fact that there has not been legislation in other states or in Idaho setting the line at 21 for the death penalty. But the Supreme Court has explained that you don't necessarily need legislation if you have overwhelming trends on the ground in terms of sentencing practices. And that makes sense because legislators have no reason to address a problem that they're really not seeing because it's so rare and so infrequently imposed. And that's the situation with the late adolescent death penalty. And I think the Atkins case is a good description of why you don't need legislation if you have that kind of proof of practices on the ground. And I would mention as well, in Granby, Florida, there were actually 39 jurisdictions that permitted the type of sentence that was being challenged. And still, because of the reality that the petitioners could point to, that didn't bar the claim. And here, you have to consider the 25 states that have abolished the death penalty altogether under Roper. So we actually have a much stronger claim. With respect to the statewide claim, I would emphasize how broad it is, both geographically and temporally. The 26 defendants who were eligible for death in terms of their age under 21 and convicted of first degree murder in Idaho, none of whom were sentenced to death. Those cases encompass 16 counties, which collectively comprise 85% of the population. They've occurred in all seven judicial districts. So I think that's pretty compelling evidence of an evolving standard of decency within Idaho if the court does not find a national consensus. I see my 20 minutes has elapsed. So unless the court has further questions, I think I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. On behalf of the state, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Counsel has discussed exclusively the merits, but the first issue that must... Oh, my light went out. Sorry. I've been sitting too still. I'm sorry. The first issue that this court has to consider is the timeliness of this claim. This case is a successive capital case. It's governed by 1927-19. And under 1927-19, timeliness is not an affirmative defense that has to be raised by the state. It has to be explicitly pled in the petition with the petitioner explaining when did they know the claim or when could they reasonably have known of the claim. That's specifically discussed extensively in particularly Fields and Stewart. Harrison has alleged that we didn't assert it as an affirmative defense. And our first response to that is, we don't have to. The state doesn't have to raise it in its responsive pleadings. But secondly, it was raised. It was raised in the answer when the state said petitioner's petition is time barred under the statute of limitations in the record on page 726. Admittedly, the prosecutor referenced Idaho Code 1949-02, but the key here is whether it was barred under the statute of limitations. In the brief supporting the state's motion for summary dismissal on pages 734 and 35 of the record, petitioner's application for post-conviction relief is time barred. It is a successive petition and contains claims that were or could have been raised in previous proceedings. That's explicitly raising the statute of limitations. More importantly, and kind of along the lines of the preservation issue that Harrison has raised, of course, this court has issued a number of decisions on preservation. One as recently as yesterday that I took a very quick look at but didn't study. And the primary principle behind preservation of issues or defenses is to give the opposing party an opportunity to respond and for the court to rule upon the issues that are raised. In this particular case, it was Harrison in his response to the motion for summary judgment that said, and I quote, this is from the record, page 737, even though Harrison repeated attention to it in his amended petition, the state never acknowledged Idaho Code 1927-19. On page 738, quote, Idaho Code 1927-19 governs in the event of any conflict with the post-conviction statute. And probably most importantly, from Harrison's responsive pleadings on page 738, quote, Harrison will continue to rely on the capital post-conviction statute where appropriate and respectfully ask the court to do the same. There's no question here that there's not in the state's mind, that there's just not a preservation issue here because it was preserved. In addition to the pleadings at oral argument, the state specifically argued, and this is on the transcript on page 14, move to dismiss under Idaho Code 1927 and submit that the court does lack jurisdiction in this case. That has to be a reference to 2719. Now, I recognize that I believe it was in Stewart, this court said that 2719 isn't really a jurisdictional bar, that it is, in fact, a statute of limitation. But if I recall my timeline correctly, I believe Stewart was actually issued after this case was argued. In any event, the prosecutor is clearly referring to 2719 because this court in Coles and the Court of Appeals in Anderson said that the statute of limitations associated with the UPCPA is not jurisdictional. Whereas prior to Stewart, this court had said that 2719 is in fact jurisdictional. So the prosecutor necessarily had to be referring to 2719 at the oral argument.
So Mr. Anderson, what was the triggering event to trigger the 42-day statute? Was it Resolution 111? Seems to me the state, if we get past the notice issue, is trying to have it both ways, as Mr. Horwitz argued, I think, in reply, is that, well, there is no national consensus, but even though there isn't, this should have been triggered at some point in the past, and he's late. So is there a consensus? Is there not? If there isn't, then how was there ever even a need to file it at any point? It's even maybe too early now if there's no consensus.
It's an interesting question, Justice Bevin, as to, in fact, whether the claim is ripe. But where Harrison is arguing that it was Resolution 111 that triggers the statute of limitation, the 42-day period, that's his argument. He's saying it started there. But everything contained within Resolution 111, which was issued, I believe it was in February of 2018, all of the citations that the ABA relied upon are science studies that existed long before, there isn't a science study cited in Resolution 111 after 2016. So if Harrison is going to rely upon the evolution of science or the alleged recognition that the brain continues to develop between the ages of 18 and 21, those studies existed no later than 2016. So the state would submit that the triggering event would be those no later than those studies in 2016. But it does raise an interesting issue, because if there isn't now, currently, a standard that says, an evolving standard that says we can't execute those between the ages of 18 and 21, then the question becomes, well, could he raise it later then? And the state submits that he could. It may not be in the context of a post-conviction, successive post-conviction petition, but if, for example, the United States Supreme Court were to conclude on the eve of Harrison's execution that we could no longer execute those individuals because of his age at the time of the crime, he'd be able to file a Rule 35 motion. His death sentence would then be illegal, and there is no statute of limitations for illegal sentences. In addition to that, he would certainly be permitted to go into federal court and file a successive habeas petition, because it would be a new rule of law, just as Gerald Pizzuto did when he raised his Atkins claim in federal court, which he is still litigating up there. So it's not like he's left without a remedy if this court were to conclude that this petition is in fact untimely, because it should have been raised much earlier. Before I move on, if the petition is untimely, as the state asserts, the state would suggest that the appeal needs to be dismissed. Anytime this court has concluded petitions in capital successive post-conviction cases are untimely, or that they otherwise fail to meet the requirements of 1927-19, the decision has been to dismiss the appeal. There's been one or two where it was affirmed, but we would suggest that it should be outright dismissed. As to the merits of the claim itself, I apologize. of course, the standard is evolving standards of decency. That's a de novo determination. That's a legal determination. I'm not aware of any court in the country that has said that it's somehow a factual determination. I think that there was one case, one or two cases where Dr. Steinberg did testify at an evidentiary hearing, but it's still a legal determination, and this court reviews that under de novo review. If we look at the cases that have discussed the evolving standards of decency, the number one criteria, and I believe it was Justice O'Connor, admittedly in dissent in Roper, the number one criteria in determining those standards are the United States Supreme Court's ultimate conclusion, what is an evolving standard of decency? Now, counsel has said that this court, that we're not asking, or they're not asking for a reversal of Roper, I think was the phrase that counsel used. But that is exactly what they're asking for. This isn't an extension of Roper like we had when we went from age 16. I don't remember the case right now where the United States Supreme Court said we can't execute anyone under the age of 16. And then we went to Roper and we can't execute anyone under the age of 18. That's an evolution. And there were standards that were that the court considered in Roper that counsel's alluded to, and I'll address in a bit. But what was important in Roper is that Roper said, this is a bright line rule. And when Utah repeatedly said, this is a bright line rule. And if you look at all of the cases that have addressed this issue, whether you can execute those between the ages of 18 and 21, the vast majority of them have focused upon the fact that the United States Supreme Court has said, it's a bright line rule. If it's a bright line rule, then it's going to require the United States Supreme Court to overrule Roper and say, no, it's not a bright line rule. It's an evolution. And those are two entirely different things. And for it's for that reason that we've argued that this court doesn't, because of the supremacy clause, have the authority to overrule Roper. That has to be done by SCOTUS, by the United States Supreme Court. Admittedly, as I said, prior to Roper and in Roper, the United States Supreme Court has looked at what has been categorized as some objective factors. They have primarily looked at legislation. That's the biggest objective factor. And there's not been a single jurisdiction in the country that has eliminated the death penalty for those between the ages of 18 and 21. I don't deny that there have been states that have eliminated the death penalty, Colorado being the most recent. But the problem that I have even with legislation is that those legislatures and those governors are the ones that are deciding what's right and what's wrong as far as who can be executed. And what I mean by that very specifically is if you look at the example in Nebraska, Nebraska, of course, their legislature some years ago and their governor eliminated the death penalty, said, we're not having it anymore. And then the citizens of Nebraska came back and said, no, we're not going to eliminate the death penalty. And by referendum, the citizens reinstated the death penalty. That's the true standard of evolving standards of decency. Is what do the people want? In California, I acknowledge that there's been a moratorium put in place by the governor. And yet the people of California, their juries, continue to impose the death penalty. Prosecutors continue to seek the death penalty. And more importantly, there were referendums a number of years ago, not that long ago, but a few years ago, where there were actually two referendums. I believe it was referendum 62 and 66. One was to eliminate the death penalty. And I'm not sure why these two referendums weren't combined. I didn't study it enough, and I don't understand enough about California. But one referendum said, we're going to eliminate the death penalty. that referendum was, quite frankly, overwhelmingly defeated. And then there was a, no, that was the one that was close, excuse me. And then there was another death penalty referendum that came in and said, well, we're going to keep the death penalty, but we're going to speed up the appellate process. That's the one that passed, quite frankly, overwhelmingly. I believe it was in somewhere in the high 50s to the low 40s. The citizens of California have concluded that the death penalty is appropriate. And again, even those states that have eliminated the death penalty, not one of them have eliminated it for those between the ages of 18 and 21. When we look at the number of at the moratoriums.
Anderson, I'm not sure I understood that last statement. Did you mean to say those states that still have the death penalty haven't eliminated it for those 18 to 21? I think you said those that have done away with it haven't done away with it for those 18 to 21.
Let me clarify what I meant by that, Justice Bevin. Those that have eliminated the death penalty have done so in its entirety. They didn't focus upon those between the ages of 18 and 21. Those that have the death penalty have not carved out an exception for those between the ages of 18 and 21. When we look at moratoriums and the number of executions, I gave an example in my supplemental briefing. We've had COVID. My wife and I's favorite restaurant is Texas Roadhouse. We haven't been able to go there for weeks. That doesn't mean that Texas Roadhouse isn't still our favorite restaurant to go to. I like to eat the peanuts. My wife likes something else.
Great cocktails? What?
Texas Roadhouse is going to open up for in-house seating tomorrow. At least that's my understanding. There was an impediment in the way. Does that mean that it was no longer our favorite restaurant? No. And that's the way it is with moratoriums and with a lack of execution. It doesn't mean that society has evolved to the point where we don't want the death penalty for 18 to 21 years old. It merely means that there's a governor that doesn't like the death penalty and has put in place an impediment. And hopefully when that governor leaves office, that impediment will be removed and those individuals can be executed. The same is true with the number of executions, only there's another reason for executions and not having them. The landmark case of Martinez versus Ryan completely changed the law in this country as far as what cases can be raised in federal habeas. Both capital and non-capital petitioners in federal court can now raise ineffective assistance of counsel claims without having presented any of them in state court. That resulted in three of our death penalty cases right after the Rhodes and Levitt's executions being remanded by the Ninth Circuit for reconsideration. We're still litigating those three cases, Creech, Roe, and in fact, Harrison. It's new law that causes these delays in executions. It's also an inability to get the drugs, which the abolitionists have made it almost impossible to get. We have to litigate protocols. It isn't because standards have evolved that we aren't executing people. It's because of the impediments created by the ongoing litigation of abolitionists. And I would suggest to the court that those individuals should not be rewarded by eliminating the death penalty simply by making it more difficult.
Mr. Anderson, Mr. Horwitz points out that since Mr. Harrison's sentence, no one who falls within the age group that he says the evolving standards of decency have changed for has been sentenced to death. And how do you respond to that?
That's true only in Idaho. There have been other individuals across the country sentenced to death between the ages of 21. The interesting thing about those individuals is that we don't know why they weren't sentenced to death in Idaho. All we have are findings and judgments. And really what Harrison is arguing here is a proportionality argument. He's saying, we need to look at these individual cases and they weren't given the death penalty. Well, number one, we don't know, except in one of the cases Harrison cited, We don't know if there was even a statutory aggravator available for a prosecutor to seek the death penalty. Secondly, we don't know what the mitigation was. And there's really no way to ascertain that. There are as many reasons for a prosecutor not to seek the death penalty as there are prosecutors. And if we take Harrison's argument to its logical extension, the one thing that I can promise you, and I don't make promises during oral argument, is that if we extend, if the court were to adopt that rationale, it would be the death of the death penalty. Because what we would have is death penalty opponents and defense attorneys that would go across the state and find every single case over the age of 21 where the death penalty was not imposed and say, it wasn't imposed there. It wasn't imposed here. In Ada County, there was a triple murder a number of years ago. The state didn't seek the death penalty. For what reasons? We don't entirely know. The reality is that death is reserved for the worst of the worst. And prosecutors have discretion to determine who those worst are. And so I would submit that that's really a very poor way to determine what are the evolving standards of decency.
What's a good way to determine it then? Obviously, the Supreme Court has tasked us with that obligation to independently make that call. What are you advocating as a good way to do that?
Your Honor, what I'm advocating is that this court not reverse or overrule Roper. And I'm not sure that there is a good standard. This court declined to do that in Abdullah and Hall. In Abdullah and Hall, this court was asked to extend Atkins to those individuals that are severely mentally ill. And this court said, no, that's the job of the United States Supreme Court. I would submit that there's no reason not to apply those two cases to this very situation. And in fact, I would submit that those two cases are binding on this court as to whether it's going to overrule Roper and extend the abolition of the death penalty for those that are 18 to 21 years old. In more direct response to your question, Justice Bevin, and I admit this wasn't really briefed, and it wasn't briefed for reasons that I really don't get into, but that's why I have a problem with the whole evolving standards of decency test. I realize that this court is stuck with it because that's what the United States Supreme Court has said. But it's such a flexible, squishy standard. They have tried to give it objective criteria, legislation, are there court cases, those type of things that I've already discussed. But as the court has said in each of its Eighth Amendment evolving standard of decency cases, it's ultimately the Supreme Court that makes that call. And that's troubling because, as we all know, the personnel on the court change. And so I think it's very, very difficult to articulate a standard as to what the evolving standards of decency really are. As to the question of the expansion of Miller and Montgomery, just very quickly, there's no reason to go down that road because the reality is that all of the concerns associated with Miller and Montgomery are necessarily encompassed in a death sentence. Why do we need to add that overlay from Miller and Montgomery to a death sentence? Before you can sentence somebody to death, you have to have a first degree murder that qualifies. The state has to establish a statutory aggravating factor. And then the state, it has to be established that the mitigation doesn't outweigh that statutory aggravator. There are so many protections associated with death penalty cases that those protections necessarily encompass Miller and Montgomery.
Well, let's talk about the protections as they applied in this case. One of the arguments that was alluded to here today, mentioned much more in the briefing, was concerns about whether the proper criteria was considered by the sentencing judge related to the age issue. And I've had an opportunity to review the findings of the court, the 14-page document imposing the death penalty. What's the state's position as far as the district judge's analysis and reasoning, especially as to the youthfulness of the defendant in sentencing?
Two responses, Justice Mueller. First, it's my recollection in Harrison 1, the consolidated appeal, that that was actually raised. And so for purposes of what I perceive your question to be, and that is a consideration of Judge McDermott's consideration of Harrison's age, that issue has been decided and affirmed by this court. I would submit that it's res judicata. It's also a successive petition on the very same issue. And this court has already determined that he adequately considered youth as a mitigating factor. And that's what youth should be considered for purposes of 18 and 21. Unquestionably, if we have a youthful murderer, it should be considered as mitigation. Has to be, it should be. But that's what it should be, mitigation, and not a prohibition on the imposition of the death penalty. If there are no other questions, the state would ask again that this case be dismissed on appeal because of the timeliness issue, or alternatively be affirmed on appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time does the appellant have?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
Mr. Horwitz, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to preservation, the state said timeliness is not an affirmative defense. I think that's a bit of a red herring, because no matter what category the limitations period has, the state still has to preserve its substantive theory for untimeliness in the district court in order to rely on it on appeal. And it simply did not do so in this case. In the district court, the state said nothing about any kind of triggering event. To the extent the prosecutor addressed the availability of the claim, the only statement he made in the district court in any pleading or at any hearing was to say that Mr. Hairston had his claim available to him at the time of his offense in 1996. And for one thing, that's clearly mistaken because the science, there's an uncontroverted statement from Dr. Steinberg in the record that the science was not available in 1996 to support a claim like this. And for another thing, that's not the argument the state is making on appeal. On appeal, the state is responding to Mr. Hairston's timeliness account. It's offering other triggering events, such as the scientific studies that Mr. Anderson mentioned, but not a word of that was breathed to the district court in any form whatsoever. So I don't see preservation as even a close question. I think the state's theory is very clearly unpreserved. There was some discussion of whether the limitations defense is jurisdictional or not. It is not jurisdictional. And this court said so in Stewart in 2010, which was long before the hearing took place below. So the state had every reason to offer its current theory to the district court, and it failed to do so. The state referred to one of the purposes of preservation as giving the other side a chance to respond, and that's true. But another central purpose of the preservation requirement is to give the district court an opportunity to rule on the argument. And the district court had no such opportunity here because it had no alternative triggering event argument from the state to address. It had no debate in front of it. And that's why the district court properly described Mr. Hairston's explanation for timeliness as, quote, unchallenged. It was unchallenged. The district court had no reason to address it, and that's why it's not preserved now for appeal. And I would also add, the state relies in part on the fact that Mr. Hairston invoked the correct limitations period. I don't think that fact should be used against him for timeliness purposes. If anything, it makes the state's waiver more apparent, because this court has emphasized that when a party has an opportunity to address an issue and it still fails to do so, then the lack of preservation is even clearer. And the Wolf case that's discussed in the reply brief is a good example of that. So I think if this court faithfully applies its preservation case law, there really is no question that the arguments the state is making on appeal are unpreserved.
What is the logic for basing the running of the statute of limitations from Resolution 111? What is there about the ABA's issuance of that creates the standard for all of the courts in the country to measure these kind of petitions by?
Your Honor, I would say, first of all, I think in a lot of courts, a lot of jurisdictions, there are more lenient timeliness rules. So I think other courts would have an opportunity to consider the claim, even in the absence of ABA Resolution 111. Idaho has a very strict timeliness rule for capital post-conviction petitions. I think the significance of the resolution is it's the first recognition of a consensus on really a national scale. And in Thompson v. Oklahoma, when the Supreme Court was addressing a similar argument, it relied in part on an ABA resolution. So we know that they have constitutional significance. And I think I would also suggest that the state doesn't have an alternative. The state's suggestion to the court is look at the earliest scientific study that was published addressing brain development for late adolescence. But that doesn't make the claim meritorious. It doesn't even make the claim colorable because we have to show a consensus, which is an agreement. So the state,
I'm just wondering at the propriety of allowing an organization, although it's an esteemed organization, certainly like the ABA, to take a position on something, and that becomes a triggering event for all the courts throughout the country. I believe if it wasn't in this case, it was in a similar case that we have going currently. The ABA has attempted to become an amicus in a case. And obviously you could say, well, here the party that wants to intervene in the case is setting the standard for the statute of limitations. And there's something about that that strikes me as maybe improprietous.
Yes, Your Honor. I can understand that concern. I would reiterate, this is a body that's been relied upon by the Supreme Court in this area of law. And I think, you know, the state says, look at the ABA resolution. It contains earlier authorities. It contains earlier studies. But if anything, I think that makes it a more legitimate triggering event because it's an encapsulation of how the consensus has evolved and changed and become more concrete with time. And again, I would come back to the fact that there's no alternative from the state, and there's no alternative that I can come up with that would provide a clear, straightforward triggering event. And that, I think if the court finds that the ABA resolution is insufficient, it will have to think carefully about what Mr. Hairston could have relied upon, because he certainly could not have relied upon the studies the state is now citing. They don't constitute a consensus, and the claim would have been meritless. And I think if the court adopts a rule that essentially requires a petitioner to bring a claim at a time when it's inevitably going to fail, that's a serious due process problem in its own right. So if this court were to create a new rule, I think that might be salutary for future petitioners. But in any event, it can't be enforced against Mr. Hairston because he had no notice of when an evolving standards claim would become ripe. He offered a clear, straightforward explanation for why he believed his was ripe. If the court rejects it, so be it. But he couldn't comply with that new rule. And I think the 2008 opinion in Pizzuto from this court is a good explanation for why, if there's a new timeline that's adopted by this court on appeal, it shouldn't hold that timeline against Mr. Hairston. On the merits, just very briefly, the state reiterated that we are asking this court to overrule Roper. I think one thing that's worth keeping in mind is that Roper was actually affirming the court below, the Missouri Supreme Court, which itself extended the line from 16 to 18. And I think that's very strong evidence that there's nothing inappropriate about a lower court doing its constitutional duty, evaluating the latest evidence and coming to its own determination about where that line should be drawn. I would say almost all of the other arguments that were offered by the state as to the merits of the national claim are very easily rejected on the basis that they are entirely inconsistent with the U.S. Supreme Court's precedent. The U.S. Supreme Court consistently relies on legislators who have abolished the death penalty. It has never discussed referenda or initiatives in that regard.
Why wouldn't referendums be direct evidence of what the people think about the societal norm? Not a legislature and not a court, but the people.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I don't mean to suggest that referenda are irrelevant. I think I was just contesting the state's idea that you can look at referenda to dispute what legislatures elsewhere have done. I think that's wholly inconsistent with the state's, with the Supreme Court's approach. The Supreme Court looks at legislatures and what they have done. It counts up the tally, and that's it. And so the states that have abolished the death penalty are absolutely relevant to this inquiry.
I think in Idaho, the jurisprudence is that referendums or initiatives are in fact a legislative act. It's very plain. And as such, jurisprudence should continue.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would agree with that. A referenda absolutely has the same status as a legislative act. But states that have abolished the death penalty legislatively, which is almost half the country at this point, they have to be taken into consideration under Roe as well. The state points out that juries are still imposing death sentences. They are doing so very, very infrequently. Only 9 late adolescent death sentences in every year since 2013. So I think that's actually a very telling statistic in our favor. And just finally, the state.
But the state, as I understand their position, is we really can't make any conclusion from that type of statistic without understanding the cases themselves. That is an analysis of whether the death penalty was even sought.
Chief Justice, I see my time is expiring. May I respond?
You may answer the question. Thank you, sir.
Your Honor, again, I think that is an idea that might have something to be said for it in a vacuum, but under the Supreme Court's law, it doesn't, because the Supreme Court looks at sentencing outcomes. That's a fundamental metric that the Supreme Court gauges an evolving standard of decency on the basis of. It doesn't ask, dissents certainly have proposed that question in the Eighth Amendment evolving standards context, but majority opinions have not. They look at the result, they look at how many death sentences are being imposed on that category of offender, and that's the data point by which they gauge the evolving standard of decency. And that's precisely what we're asking this court to do. And I believe it's required under the Supreme Court's precedent.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
At this time, this matter is under advisement and we will render a decision. Court is in recess. Thanks to both counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you.